More officially, I am the speaker who will introduce the speaker, Professor William Kremel. Well, I was going to give him this one. Okay. Are Unitarian Universalists today called to defend their faith? Or, yes, we are called to defend our faith. That's an odd thing for Unitarian Universalists to be called to defend their faith. Usually we hear that frame from a more conservative religious sector, or we hear defend God, Queen, and King, or however that might go. But what does that feel like to hear Unitarian Universalists in the same sentence, command, or question to defend our faith? Just a brief words from Samuel Price Kowalski, who in 1670 spoke words in defense of the Polish law that guaranteed religious tolerance, religious freedom, and freedom of rights. And he is one of our faith ancestors. And what he struggled for was, and this again is in 1670, 1660, freedom of dissent, freedom of conscience, separation of church and state, social equality, religious absolute tolerance, freedom of assembly. Religious of absolute tolerance was important because in some places, Catholics, Calvins, Lutherans were accepted and nobody else. In some places, just Catholics were accepted and nobody else. And not to be accepted, and Calvinists in some places and nobody else, and Lutherans in some places, nobody. One place where Unitarians were welcomed, and that was in Poland. So that was a big cry for absolute religious tolerance, because that gave us a space and a place to be. And out of that place and space to be in Europe at that time, one of the few places that our way of thinking could exist, we are characterized by the principles of freedom of dissent, freedom of speech. Those words are familiar, are they not? Listen to these words by Samuel Przekalowski. The freedom of dissent is not only the right, but also the fundamental right on which is based the integrity of the freedom of the republic. Now, these principles are out of his religious sensibilities and out of his energy to create a space where our way of life could exist. So they're in the Constitution. One thing that I have learned this weekend from listening to Professor William Kremel and part of introducing him is that the Bill of Rights, as I have historically understood it, was a defense against oppression from government and from religious groups. That we would have a right to speak, the right of free press to address our grievances. So it was a defensive stance. I'm learning something different now. To quote, individual and minority rights, which was my predominant view of the Bill of Rights, individual and minority rights did constitute a motif in the Bill of Rights, but not the sole or even the dominant motif. A close look at the bill reveals structural ideas tightly interconnected with language of rights, states' rights, majority rights, alongside individual and minority rights, and protection of various intermediate associations, church, militia, jury. Designed to create and educate an educated and virtuous electorate, the genius of the bill was not to downplay organizational structure, but to deploy organizational structure, not to impede popular majorities, but to empower them. I'm still working to wrap my head around understanding what that means. The Bill of Rights are a unit, not individual rights as I projected upon them, but they are a unit to give people power in order to be proactive in creating a society where our faith principles can dominate. I did not understand that before. When a teacher comes into our space, Professor Kremel, when a teacher comes into our space, the best we can hope for is a light from the mystic or the Sufis, or a new perspective from the humanist and rationalist. The best we can hope for is something new, a new way of understanding. Bill Kremel has brought knowledge that has resulted in that light or new perspective for me, and I hope for others. And for that, I thank you. His words can help us understand the Constitution better, but I think more importantly, his words are going to help us defend our faith better. Dr. Kremel.
Thank you very much, Gregory. I appreciate it. And I'm very happy to be here. We had a wonderful group yesterday, and I've already shaken some hands here. This is a wonderful group here this morning, so thank you for inviting me. I'm going to be brief. What I'm going to try to give you is a framework and some touchstones. And then we can fill in the blanks with email and all this kind of thing later. I want you to think of government and what can happen to government as a trichotomy. All right? This is a little bit new. We all understand, and we have had the unfortunate history of public sector tyranny. We all know the names of awful people who coalesce power into themselves or a very narrow party or a very narrow military group or a family or a corporation. Well, I'm going to leave a corporation out for now. That engage in the most horrible kinds of persecutions of peoples and war and so forth. In the center, we have constitutional democracy, ruled by the people, sure, the filtrations of intermediate institutions and so forth. I'm going to try to help you to see that at the other extreme, there is something that we've never seen before, but we're beginning to see, and that is private sector tyranny. Private sector tyranny. Again, we all know about Hitler, Stalin, Idi Amin, Pol Pot. We all know about that and the over-aggregation of public power. What you're now seeing is the real-world embodiment of what Aristotle talked about when he talked about the corruption of aristocracy into oligarchy. Oligarchy ruled by the few. The corporations have taken over. They are the real government. What you see up there, the Congress, the President, they're just junior partners now. They're just junior partners. They're pretty much the lackeys of the real power in this country. And it exists in the corporate boardrooms. It exists on K Street, that place where all of the lobbyists have their offices. That's where the bills are written now. They're not written in the Congress anymore. They come over with, here's your piece of legislation. We wrote it up for you last night. You just sit down, shut up, and pass it. See? So on the other extreme of the trichotomy, three, private sector tyranny. And we are now dominated in three core relationships. One is already in the Constitution. I'm going to talk about it a little bit. And that is the relationship of the loan. Okay? What is your relationship with someone who is your creditor? Okay? That's in the Constitution. I'm going to talk about it. But I want you to put that economic relationship next to two others. One is the wage. Okay? How many people in America today are receiving a fair wage? Okay? So it's not just the loan, it's also the salary. And then your third principal economic interaction is the purchase, the price. Are you getting a fair price when you buy things? Or are the oligopolies, the economic aggregation of a few, which manifests itself politically in oligarchy, notice oligopoly and oligarchy are first cousins. One's economic, one has to do with politics. Okay? So the oligopolies are fixing prices. I can remember when antitrust law was very powerful, and we all know the history of Theodore Roosevelt, the Sherman Antitrust Act, the Clayton Antitrust Act, all this kind of thing. All right? You don't hear about antitrust anymore. Okay? Bill Clinton, nothing for 7.5 years. And the violation of Netscape by Microsoft, anybody who knows anything about computers knows what was going on. And the hue and cry was so great that Clinton finally prosecuted his old friend Bill Gates. He didn't really want to do it. Okay? But that's the way it is. So you're getting hit today in your three principal interactions. In loans, in wages, and in prices. That is private sector tyranny. And rather than a great aggregation under a Hitler or a Stalin, someone like that, what you're getting is great dispersion. They want to disperse you. You're just a customer. That's all you are. You're just an employee. That's all you are. You're just a borrower. That's all you are. Okay? And those are the subordinate conditions in the three economic interactions that are the hallmarks of private sector tyranny. All right? No Hitler, no Stalin. No, no. Just a lot of corporations who dominate your three principal economic interrelationships. Okay? It's a very sad time. Complicated story, but it began with the dominance of corporations in campaign finance. Okay? That's a long, long road to travel. I'm going to try to be very brief about it. In 1976, there was a Supreme Court case, Buckley versus Valeo. I've written about it, a number of other people have written about it. And that case struck down what had been good faith congressional legislation, 1971 and again 1974, to restrict contributions, to try to keep big money out of politics. And that case, incredibly, made a distinction between contributions and expenditures. One justice, Wizard White, the old football player, stood up and wrote that this is silly. Why would you differentiate contributions from expenditures? The reason you get the contribution is for the expenditure. Why do you say, oh no, the artisans of the Supreme Court, an increasingly conservative court, this is after Earl Warren, all right, you're into the 70s here, okay? Said, no, well, you know, you can do it. Contributions, you can keep some lid on. But expenditures, so people of great wealth, or people who could aggregate what's called bundling, which is what a corporation does, okay? It goes around and everybody puts money in the envelope. Well, it came from an individual, right? Well, not really. You know, it really came from the corporations. Okay? That's what happened. And then a number of cases since then. The Davis case, the Millionaire's Amendment, they threw that out. The people who have a great deal of private wealth, they spend all they want, and the public sector is not entitled to create a level playing field. That was thrown out. Wisconsin Right to Life, which had to do with the awful ads that were run up there within the time period whereby these issue ads that really weren't issue ads weren't supposed to be aired, that was thrown out, okay? And I wrote a little piece on that. If you Google my name, it's the American Constitutional Society, you see the piece I wrote about that case. And now we have what is really only the capstone case. I mean, the only thing that surprises me is how many people are surprised. Okay? The Citizens United was just the final hammering into the ground of the American citizen. And the corporations are now free to just give as much money as they want and buy what's left of our system. They already owned pretty much all of it. So I'm just going to give you a couple things out of the Constitution that I think support our position. The Constitution and its interpretation has been stolen by the right, no question about it. The Cato Institute and this, the Federalist Society and the Heritage Society, American Enterprise, you know the list of these organizations, very well financed, people like the Koch brothers and so forth. I mean, it's just been going on for a long, long time. They bought the system. Okay. So let's look at some things. I'm going to go through this fairly quickly here. In the third article of the Constitution, the jurisdiction is very clear. This is the judicial article. It deals with the courts, okay? Judicial power, all right? The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity, okay? Don't have time for the long history. Late 14th century, when the common law became very constipated and really not able to deliver justice, people began to go to the chancellor. And the chancellor began to give opinions, and those were respected. And so a very separate body of law grew up, and that's called equity. All right? Equity is still a part of our law. In the late 19th century, the British merged with legal and equitable jurisdiction so that one court had both jurisdictions, and we've done that in this country. But the point is that the underlying notions of equity are on our side of this argument over campaign finance reform. That's the important thing to remember. If you go back to the 14th Amendment, after the slaves were freed, 1868, equal protection. Where does equal protection come from? All of those rights that came, Brown versus the Board of Education, Baker versus Carr, reapportionment, that kind of thing, Lennon versus Sims, all of those kinds of cases, those are all based on equal protection, and equal protection in turn is based upon a very strong notion of a fundamental equity, a fundamental fairness, what's sometimes called substantial fairness in the old English writings. That's been lost. It's there for us. Reclaim equity. All right? Second category, sectors. Now, it's very clear that the Constitution, and I've written things on this, separates out the private and the public sectors. All right? What happened in this country is that the public sector lost out. Okay? But let's be clear about something. Although the original seven articles of the Constitution admittedly are fairly conservative, okay? And they have as their overriding purpose the protection of property and contract. These were the Hamiltonians, the Federalists, pretty conservative guys, and they looked upon government as something of an aristocracy, white males who had property, and that was really all who wanted to participate. But do not forget something, and people sometimes don't understand this. The people who wrote the Bill of Rights were the opposition. Okay? The people who wrote the Bill of Rights and the people who advocated the Bill of Rights and who wrote what we call the Anti-Federalist Papers, the response to the Federalist Papers, were of the other political persuasion. So the Bill of Rights is inherently liberal. And as we were saying here, aggregative. Not just minority rights, but the right to come together in the public sector. The public sector is on your majoritarian side. Okay? Remember that when you get to the sectors. Judges and juries. There's no question that historically, back in England, and then in the early days of the American Republic, the judges were overwhelmingly conservative. They were Federalists. They were appointed to protect property interests and so forth, and that was what it was all about. But we included in our system juries. Juries had been mentioned first in Magna Carta, 1215. Juries were representative of the average citizens who served in a capacity in a specific court case to look at the facts and to see whether or not someone was being taken advantage of. The jury is on our side. And I'm going to, if I've got a minute here at the end, I'll give you the two provisions in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, that are the core provisions that have to do with the question of debts and the role of the jury. All right? The fourth thing I would have you remember is that there is a huge difference in the Constitution between the voter and the contributor. Voting is in the Constitution. It's clear that people are going to vote for members of the House of Representatives directly, indirectly for the Senate, all right, until the amendment of 1913, indirectly for president, the Electoral College, which I have some problems with, but that's the way the founders set it up. Okay? So all of that was in there with the assumption that people will be voting. Contributors are not in the Constitution. Okay? There's nothing in the Constitution to protect the rights of contributors. That is a lesser public participation. The vote is the crown jewel of democracy. That's the most important thing. And that's in the Constitution. Giving money, particularly giving very large amounts of money, is not protected in the Constitution. All right, here's a fifth point. What is the difference between a small contribution and a large contribution? Now, obviously, there is a very silly, simple answer, and that is that there is a quantitative difference. Someone who gives $50 is going to be less influential than someone who gives $50,000 simply because it's more money. Okay? And so you really want to maybe listen to the $50,000 person. That person is really helping you in your campaign, the $50 person. You shake his hand, but, you know, okay? But that's not the most important point. The most important point is that there is also a qualitative difference between a small and a large contribution. And here's what it is. If you give $50 to a candidate, maybe $100 to a candidate, you know that that $50 to $100 will be commingled, all right, with a bunch of other contributions from other people. In other words, you don't expect something specific back for your $50 contribution. You just like that person, honest person, smart person, your ideological flight. Okay, so here's $50. But there is nothing specific coming back. All right? When you give $50,000, there's not just a quantitative change, there is a qualitative change. Because what do you expect for $50,000? You expect a private, interactional relationship. Okay? Even Justice Stevens, in the dissent of Citizens United, said there's a question of quid pro quo. Well, I have great respect for Justice Stevens. He went to the same law school I did. His grades are probably even better than mine. And he's on the Supreme Court, and I'm not, or he was, all right? But he didn't go quite far enough. I don't use the term quid pro quo. I use the term contract. That when someone contributes a very large amount of money, in effect they are engaging in a contract with the office seeker. And the office seeker, by receiving that amount of money, you know, you've been to law school, offer an acceptance, okay, accepts, and they're, okay, we have a contract. You offered me this. I know what you want. You want this loophole in the tax code. You want this regulatory waiver. You want to be able to do something overseas that takes jobs away from, et cetera, et cetera. You want something specific for a large amount of money. You see how that's a qualitative difference, quite apart from just it's more money, so you should pay more attention to me? There's a qualitative difference. Okay, now let me show you something. The Constitution is a very complex instrument. It really is. A perfect Constitution, I'm going to say this very slowly, an absolutely perfect Constitution is merely procedural. In other words, all it does is set up the structures and processes of the government. Here are the institutions, whether it's a parliament or the Congress or whatever. And here's how they operate, how people vote for them. Here's what they can do. They can pass money bills. They can coin money, blah, blah, blah. You know, all right. And that's all in the Constitution. A perfect Constitution is only procedural. In other words, it sounds funny to say this, but the perfect Constitution has no substance to it. Okay? It's only the rules of the game. It's the rules of the competition between and amongst the various interests. Everybody with me? Mm-hmm. All right. The American Constitution is near perfect. It's about 99.44%, 100%. I would say it's the ivory soap test. You remember that? About 99.44%, 100% pure. Okay? It's procedural. But you know what? The founders weren't perfect. And once, they slipped up. They slipped up, and they put a little substance in the Constitution. They put substance by saying, this is what we really want. And so there is in the Constitution a substantive provision that tips their hand. It shows you what it is that they really want from their system. All right? And here it is. Article 1, which is the article on the Congress, you know. Section 10. No state shall enter into any treaty, Alaska Federation, of grant letters of marks, payment of debts, or pass any law impairing the obligation of contracts. Okay? That's not a procedural statement. That has nothing to do with the structure of the system. And nothing to do with the processes of the system. It is a substantive, what should be a statutory statement. But they stuck it in the Constitution. Because what was going on? Some states, like Rhode Island, printing paper money, create inflation, so that debtors were paying back cheaper money. Okay? Moratoriums on payment. Loans, okay? Well, we'll give you a year. You had a bad year, bad crop, okay? We pass a moratorium. All right? Judges who were too favorable to creditors. Oh, 1 year term for all of our judges. That's what states like Rhode Island had, and you didn't get back. Or they'd cut your salary. So all the things that were in the Constitution, guess what? Guess what? They didn't want any interference with contracts. There is the substantive provision in the Constitution that tips the hand of what the Federalists really wanted. They didn't want any interference by the public, like a state government, in the loan contract, the wage contract, or the price contract. Okay? They were specifically talking about loans. They were specifically talking about loans at that time. But of course, not many people worked for other people in those days, so now we have wages and we have price. But go back and read that section. Now, what did the Anti-Federalists, remember the Bill of Rights, the opponents of the original seven articles, okay? The original seven articles were written by the Federalists. The Bill of Rights were written by the Anti-Federalists, the people who were very concerned about an oligarchy, the rule of the few. So what is the key provision in the Bill of Rights? Now, most people say, well, the First Amendment, you know, the freedom of speech, all that kind of thing. No, that's not the principal provision. Fourth Amendment, search and seizure. Fifth Amendment, not even testify against yourself. Sixth Amendment, rights to an attorney, all that kind of thing. That's what everybody points to. But that's not the most important thing. The most important amendment is the amendment that no one says anything about. You can't find it. I found one 1,700-page law school textbook that had three sentences on this amendment. Three sentences. What is the amendment that you've never heard of? Which amendment have you never heard of? The Seventh Amendment. The Seventh Amendment. You've read my stuff. That's good. Thank you. It's the Seventh Amendment. You're right. There's almost nothing written about it. There was one little case in the 1880s saying it didn't apply to the states. What did the Seventh Amendment say? In suits of common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States. Ooh, what does that mean? No fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States. Who did they, the Anti-Federalists, assume would be on the juries? People who were normal, regular people who would be sympathetic to someone who had a debt, who had a loan, okay? They had a loan that was unfair, that was unjust, that had taken advantage of someone. Okay? You remember Shays Rebellion? That was about mortgages. Okay? And now I'm going to go back and end up with Hamilton. Now, you know, Hamilton was very conservative. And Hamilton was a person who wanted to reassure people, because he wanted the Constitution to pass, that don't worry, equity will still be there with you. So here are three sentences to remember from Hamilton, right in the middle of the time that he's talking about strong courts, judicial review, judges not being able to be recalled, lifetime appointment for judges, not being able to cut the salary of judges. He wants to reassure the others, don't worry, you'll be taken care of. This is hardly a subject of litigation between individuals. Excuse me, there is hardly a subject of litigation, which may not involve those ingredients of fraud, accident, trust, or hardship, which would render the matter an object of equitable rather than of legal jurisdiction. Notice that. Of equitable. Even Hamilton had recognized equity. As the distinction is known and established in several of the states, and as it was known back in England. It is the peculiar province, for instance, of a court of equity to relieve against what are called hard bargains. There's your key phrase, the hard bargain. Go back again to the loan, to the wage, to the price. Are they fair bargains? Are they hard bargains? Even Hamilton had to recognize that there are hard bargains. What are they? One more sentence here. Long sentence, but a very important sentence. These are contracts in which, though there may have been no direct fraud or deceit sufficient to invalidate them in a court of law, yet there may have been some undue and unconscionable advantage taken of the necessities or misfortunes of one of the parties. They had a bad crop. They couldn't pay off the mortgage. They got new mortgage terms that were onerous, unfair, which a court of equity would not tolerate. See? So even in those three sentences, Hamilton has to concede that there are circumstances where people take advantage of people. And he was trying to say to the other side, people who might not want to ratify the Constitution, and you know there was great opposition to the Constitution. There, a lot of people didn't want to pass the Constitution. That those people needed to be mollified. Don't worry. You've got equity on your side. I recognize that there are hard bargains. Well, that's what we've got today. We have three forms of hard bargains. We have private sector tyranny. At the other end of the spectrum of the highly aggregated, concentrated Hitler-Stalin kind of public sector tyranny, the private sector tyranny, rule of the few, an abusive rule of the few, the corporations, private sector tyranny. All right? Thank you very much. Yes, please. Speak up because my hearing aid batteries went down.
I assume that there is a community of constitutional lawyers or constitutional experts. And my question is, where is the outrage in that community about what is taking place?
Well, there is a group called the American Constitution Society, which was started by Lawrence Tribe, Janet Reno, who was Attorney General under Clinton, and other kind of liberal types. It was in some ways too little too late, but at least it was something I was a member of. They have what are called issue briefs. And I say, if you Google my name, William P. Kremel, you will see a short piece. They ask for a couple thousand words. It's all a semi-academic and some footnotes, but they wanted something that to be understandable to the lay citizen. My idea of how to overturn not just Citizens United, but that whole outrage of cases that started with Buckley, and I wrote about Buckley back then. I said, my goodness, this is a great privatization. And in my last chapter, I said, this privatization of the law is similar, and I pointed out some specifics, to the worst privatization case in all of American history, which is what? What is the worst outrage of an extension of the private sector in all of American constitutional law? Dred Scott.
Yeah.
It's Dred Scott, where a black person was considered property.
Yeah.
We think of that as a race case, and it certainly is. But it also has the second theme, and that is the private public.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an extreme privatization, okay? Because it was basically a protection of property, even if the property was human beings, but it was property. Mm-hmm. And there are parallels, I think, between Dred Scott and Buckley versus Blight.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, that's in my book. I apologize. I brought down a bunch of books, really two, one having to do with sectors that I had written, and the other dealing with campaign finance reform. And the first yesterday, I bought them all. But if anybody wants to leave me a card or ask me, I'll be glad to put a book in a mailer and someone say at my cost, the little paperback on campaign finance reform is $10, and then there's a hardback that's on sectors, which is $20. But if anybody wants to give me a card or whatever, yes, ma'am.
What is our leverage at this point? What can happen? What can citizens do? What can happen within the system to right what's gone awry with the privatization?
Well, I don't think there's any question. But the ultimate recourse is to be really well informed, and to be informed at the highest possible intellectual level. And I don't mean just some abstraction for the sake of abstraction, but having a really clear understanding of what the Constitution preserves. And that's what I tried to do today, show you, five dichotomies of touchstones, as well as even Hamilton's admission. I mean, that's quite a considerable thing that even Hamilton felt it necessary to write a little three-sentence caveat, admitting that there was a real fear and danger that the private sector could completely overwhelm the system, and he's trying to reassure the other guys. So his acknowledgement of the possibility, in fact the reality, of the hard bargain is significant, is really significant. But, it, you know, it's like everything else. The first way to solve a problem is to understand it. And there's so much misunderstanding out there. But, you know, the Constitution, at least part of it, is on our side. No one talks about the Seventh Amendment. But my issue brief piece, as you can see if you Google my name, is based on the Seventh Amendment. Because what I say is, a large contribution is a contract. And what the Seventh Amendment says is that a jury can find a contract to be unjust and therefore, to use the legal term, encumber the contract. Okay? Can you encumber a contract? I would argue the Seventh Amendment permits you to do that, but again, no one pays any attention to the Seventh Amendment except this gentleman here.
I had a question with when you talked about the merging of the equity courts and the constitutional courts.
Yeah.
Because they are merged in the United Kingdom and here,
right.
What is our legal recourse if you...
Most of what is equity, of course, is personal stuff. In other words, it's the notion of doctrine of clean hands, the restraining order, the temporary injunction, the permanent injunction. Equity acts what's called in personam, okay? Acts on the individual, whereas the law acted what is called in rem, that acts on the thing, okay? So you get money damages if you win in a civil case in law. In equity, you want to stop somebody from doing something. They see a wrecking ball coming up the street, and the guy's got the wrong address, okay? And he's lining up to hit your house. Oh, no, it's the guy next door who's tearing down the house. You know, you don't want money damage. I mean, you could sue them later, but my God, is that really what you want? You run down to a magistrate, you get a temporary restraining order. You can't do this. All right, that's what equity did. But equity had this notion of basic fairness. It was not as rigid as the law. Remember, it was the rigidities that so angered people, and they started to go to the chancellor.
But if as an individual voter, I've been disenfranchised, but these corporations are now people, and they, in fact, my vote has been devalued.
Absolutely.
So does that fit within the context of equity law?
Absolutely, because, I'm going to argue equal protection. I'm going to argue that your vote is minimized in a way that is not dissimilar from what happened to people who came, more or less recent immigrants, who went into the large cities, but the state governments stopped reapportioning as their constitution said that they should every 10 years. And so what happened was that the small town and rural areas had districts with only maybe 1,000 people in it, but the center, core city, had 25,000 or something for districts. That's what you're talking about. Yes, they have bought the system, and there's only one way out of it, and that is to plead equity. This is not what it's all about. Okay. Yes, Kathy.
Have you a website, sir?
I don't have a website. I ran for office a few times and I had a website, but I took it down. I'm a semi-retired college professor. This is my 46th year, so I'm over the hill. I just give lectures and write books and do a little teaching. I don't know if I'll ever run for office.
You can find his work on the internet. His articles and his work on the internet.
Did you read about the Seventh Amendment?
Did you?
You did yesterday.
Yes, that's one.
Could somebody who feels that their bank has tricked them or somehow manipulated the system so their interest rate that was 12% is all of a sudden 30% file for the equity in a court?
Well, hopefully, yes. I mean, one of the things that I wrote on some years ago was the decline of the middle class. I'm delighted that Elizabeth Warren
You know, Elizabeth Warren?
Yes.
She cited me in her book. She wrote a book, I think it was 2000, called The Fragile Middle Class. Mm-hmm. And she cited me briefly. Two little places, nothing grand, but she acknowledged my book on the middle class that came out in 1997. And she's very good, and I'm very happy that there is now going to be a consumer finance protection agency that just deals with the loan aspect and particularly the credit card industry, which is just a bunch of thieves. I mean, it's just outrageous. And she puts it herself in a book that specializes in tricking people. You know, so having not just fair rates, but also understandable pure English statements wind up with all these fees at the end of the month, or if you overcharge them at any point during the month, they were counting that as the first of the month, so that all the rest were also overcharged. I mean, mm-hmm. just the list went on and on. So I'm very honored that she did cite my book, that's the kind of thing that we're going to have to do. Now, I'm worried, just to finish the thought here, that the Republicans in the House, and of course that's where money bills start, are going to underfund it. You know, it's like education. Hmm. You know, this great deal with Ted Kennedy and so forth, no child left behind, well, every child left behind because they didn't put anything money in it. I mean, you can write a piece of legislation, but as you know, in the Congress, the appropriation process is a wholly separate process. So you can pass a law, but that doesn't mean you have any money for it. You have to go through an appropriations process, and there are people on there, and certainly now in those committees that are dominated by the Republicans, as you know, committee swing with the George, they don't want to give her any money. And that's what really concerns me. She could have a little office with four people on the 61 ball. You know?
Yeah.
That isn't going to cut it. That isn't going to cut it.
Okay.
Anybody